From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell vowed to move ahead with a vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh by the end of this week.
After the FBI shares what they've found, senators will have the opportunity to vote. We'll have the opportunity to vote no on the politics of personal destruction. We'll have the opportunity to vote yes on this fine nominee.
But the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein, told reporters today that a vote that soon wouldn't give senators enough time to weigh the information uncovered in the FBI's investigation into allegations of sexual assault against Kavanaugh. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
You know, this has followed a pattern of investigations over the decades. It starts out as one claim, a claim of a sexual attack, serious claim. And now it seems to be about what Judge Kavanaugh said about his drinking in high school and college. So many people coming forward to say he didn't tell the truth. You can't lie under oath. So first, what are you hearing as these friends come forward? Is this swaying Republican senators as we're hearing about the drinking?
So far, not really. At this point, Republican senators are sitting back and waiting for this FBI investigation to be concluded and to try to have a vote this Friday, as you noted there with Mitch McConnell saying that there will be a vote this Friday, and that they anticipate that Brett Kavanaugh will be exonerated through what is a limited FBI investigation.
President Trump initially said the FBI investigation could be a blessing in disguise, but that was when the FBI had been instructed, it seems, to interview just four witnesses, three who might have been in the house when a sexual attack took place, and then a second accuser. Now the FBI has been given broader latitude. Do we know who else they're talking to?
We don't know exactly, but the White House can set parameters for the investigation. We don't know how wide that is or who else they're seeking to talk to. So far, we know that the FBI has spoken to Leland Kaiser, a friend of Christine Blasey Ford's, Deborah Ramirez, the second accuser from lives in Colorado and accuses Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct while in college, and Kavanaugh's friends, Mark Judge and P.J. Smith. Ryan Lucas has confirmed those for NPR. The president says he wants to give the FBI full latitude, but he said, quote, within reason, and doesn't want a witch hunt. They have not spoken to Christine Blasey Ford, though we did hear her testimony quite a bit. So, you know, we don't know what else would be there. And we don't know if they're speaking to any number of other potential witnesses.
Well, then there's Yale classmate Chad Lunnington, now a college professor. He's the one who said that drunken, you know, even loutish behavior shouldn't deny someone a career. He says that would make me a hypocrite to say that, implying, you know, he also had the behavior. And then he went into detail having that behavior with Brett Kavanaugh, because he says Kavanaugh, it bothered him that Kavanaugh's not being truthful. And Ludington's the one who talked about the bar fight in 1985. Police were called. This was in New Haven. They were at Yale. And Ludington says he's since seen the report. Let's listen.
Brett threw his beer at the guy. I actually now found out from the report that it wasn't beer, that I had misremembered. It was ice cubes and whatever the drink was that he was drinking. I guess that is, you know, we weren't drinking water, so it must have been some sort of mixed drink.
So, Domenico, a couple of things. People are saying, wait a second, you get into a bar fight and police are called and you're in a police report and that doesn't show up in FBI vetting. But we heard on Morning Edition that, you know, the vetting only goes back 18 years. But a police report, throwing a glass, you know, Democrats seem to be switching now to asking about Kavanaugh's temperament.
Yeah, they certainly are. Most Republicans have pretty much made up their minds pending the results of this FBI investigation. A lot of Democrats are talking about how he presented himself at that hearing and whether he was too partisan, for example, to have the temperament to sit on the Supreme Court. It really was the most partisan performance by a Supreme Court nominee in American history.
Yeah. Look, it's playing out differently depending on who you're listening to. Just briefly, what are media organizations friendly to President Trump? What are they saying?
Well, it's a different world. I mean, if you look at FoxNews.com, for example, they're focused on Richard Blumenthal's misleading statements during his senatorial campaign about his Vietnam service. If you look at Breitbart, for example, they're mocking a CNN analyst for the idea that Kavanaugh could be falsely accused.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the death toll from the earthquake in Indonesia and the tsunami that followed is now more than 1,200. The worst devastation is in Sulawesi province, including the city of Palu. Joining us now is the BBC's Mariko Oi in Palu. Mariko, what is it like there?
Well, Jeremy, we just actually arrived in Palu after driving for about 30 hours from the city of Makassar, which is in the south of the island. We thought it would only take about 18 hours to get here. Obviously, it was because the commercial flights were not being accepted at the local airport here to give the priority to all the chartered planes to deliver all the supplies. It took longer partly because the last 200 kilometers into Palu, we had to be escorted in by the police because of some reports that cars coming in here were being looted. To be honest, I'm not sure if I feel comfortable calling them looters, though, because obviously survivors are so desperate to get hold of food and water, which they haven't managed to get hold of all weekend. If anything, we've been somewhat struck by the generosity of the people along the way, offering food and limited water that they have, and some people standing on the streets collecting donations as well with hashtag pray for Palu. As we drove in, we were told that there were some clashes between the police and locals, but it seems quite calm as we arrived. And I should also emphasize that it is unbearably hot during the day here. So after losing your loved ones and not being able to get hold of water and food, you can understand some people get irritable in this heat.
What are the needs of the people who are there right now?
It's all the basic essential supplies, water, food, petrol. You know, the city is completely out of petrol. You know, as we drove in, there was a long, long queue in the nearby town where cars were queuing up to buy petrol. All of us brought our own in, but water and food are very scarce as well. Of course, the government has been trying to get them delivered by road or by plane, but because the local airport was damaged by the tsunami as well, it has been very challenging. And the road journey that we did takes so long that locals here say that they haven't managed to get much of what was promised.
Is the plan right now to get aid to people who are there, or to try to get as many people out of the area as possible while they figure out what needs to be done?
I think it's a bit of both, of course, but I think it's the former, that they're trying to get the aid in so that survivors can at least eat and get some clean water to begin with. Of course, some of the severely injured survivors have been taken out of Palu to Makassar to get treated, but the flights have been quite. We've been getting a lot of information whether they can start flying, and then you know people got on the plane, and then we're told that no, we can't land in Palu. So there are a lot of confusions, as you can imagine. Even though Indonesia is prone to these earthquakes, and you know many of your listeners would probably remember the strong earthquakes that struck in Lombok several months ago, and of course the one in 2004, which killed hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia alone. This country, it doesn't have the financial means, I guess, to be prepared as other countries. You know, when we were driving into Palu, we saw some modestly built houses, you know, wooden houses along the coastline, and probably very similar to that of Palu. They're not strong enough to withstand an earthquake or tsunami, and that's despite the fact that all these earthquakes have happened here, that people just don't have the financial means to build anything that's strong enough.
We're also hearing about concerns of the spread of disease.
Yes, that is definitely a concern, and mass burial has been taking place gradually here in Palu. In that sense, the authorities are quite well prepared, or they have quite a lot of experiences, unfortunately, from the previous earthquakes. I think, if anything, people are starting to talk about whether the warning system was working. That has been one of the main topics that I've been hearing over the last couple of days, that, you know, when the earthquake hit on Friday evening, you know, was the alarm system, which was supposed to have been implemented after the 2004 tsunami, was it working to alert people to run? And we got the confirmation from the authorities that they weren't working, mainly because the government couldn't get the funding to keep maintaining that system properly. So some experts have been voicing criticism that it's heartbreaking to see so many lives being lost when the systems could have saved many lives. Of course, others would disagree that it's too early to start pointing fingers at each other, and that every earthquake, every tsunami is different, that there's no perfect system. But there are some questions that the local authorities and the government will have to answer. But at the moment, the focus has really been on rescuing those who are still believed to be trapped underneath the rubble.
That's the BBC's Mariko Oi joining us from Palu, the epicenter of the devastation from this tsunami. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This week, the Trump administration announced that it had reached a new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, a revision of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Larry Summers, the former Secretary of the Treasury under President Clinton, former top economic advisor under President Obama, and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Larry Summers, welcome back to Here and Now.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
And let's start with this trade agreement, the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. What do you think of it?
Never seen so much ado about so little. I thought the old trade regime between Canada, Mexico, and the United States was a good one. And this one's not very different. How it could possibly be worth major alienation of major allies, I can't imagine. These are relatively small changes. The vast majority of NAFTA is continuing as it was. This has been a major diversion from the important domestic challenges facing the United States and the important international challenges. But I'm happy with the new agreement, principally because I was happy with the old agreement. And I can't imagine why someone who was profoundly troubled by the old agreement should be happy with the new agreement. So this is more in the nature of a publicity stunt than an international diplomatic act.
So when President Trump said this is proof that my strategy worked, that I put pressure on Canada and Mexico and I got what I wanted and our dairy farmers are going to be in better shape now, you say what?
I say any changes are tiny compared to the overall economy. The ill will we have created with respect to the Canadians and the Mexicans will have costs that will exceed any benefits. The ability of North America to remain unified when we face very serious challenges from Asia has been constrained. This has been the most short-sighted of strategies for the most negligible gain.
Do you feel the same way about what's happening vis-a-vis trade with China right now?
I think there are major issues in the U.S.-China trading relationship. It seems to me the strategies we have used to go after them have been quite problematic. They embolden the strongest and most hostile to the United States elements within the Chinese government. They encourage the Chinese on a road to self-sufficiency and independence from the United States, which ultimately will reduce our leverage and influence. They fail to mobilize the moral and political force of the entire international community, which is surely the most effective way to influence Chinese behavior. I think that any conscientious American administration would be addressing issues about Chinese trade practices, and in particular the ones relating to intellectual property. But I don't think the strategy or the tactics has been well calculated to maximize long-run American interests.
And what about President Trump's argument that U.S. coffers are filling up because of these tariffs, that we're collecting a lot more money on everything that is being brought in from China?
There are all kinds of ways of raising taxes if you want. Tariffs are taxes. They are taxes that fall principally on the goods that people buy and the inputs that companies need in order to compete. That's why they are taxes that are particularly regressive and particularly inefficient. And so there's something very odd about an administration that prides itself on its tax cutting, focusing on cutting the taxes for corporations and raising the taxes on the ordinary goods, the toys that parents buy for their kids at Christmas.
So are you surprised then that Republicans who have long campaigned on being tax cutters and being against taxes are not speaking up about these tariffs?
I've stopped being surprised at Republican cravenness in front of President Trump. It is clear, and you know, I'm an economist, not a politician or a political scientist, but it's quite clear that Republican congressmen and senators are in great fear of a primary challenge sponsored and supported by President Trump. And President Trump may not have a majority within America with him. Indeed, his approval rating suggests that it's well under 50%. But he does have a big majority within the Republican Party, and he's prepared to ruthlessly use that to impose party discipline. And therefore, he is able to rally Republican congressmen and senators who value their survival as political leaders more than their previous convictions to stand by his side. You know, the book has moved somewhat out of fashion, but John Kennedy wrote a great book called Profiles in Courage about senators who regarded their core beliefs as being more important to them than their reelection. I just wish we were seeing more Profiles in Courage in the Senate these days on trade issues and, frankly, on some other issues as well.
What do you think of what the Fed is doing right now? They just raised interest rates again. Inflation is up above 2%, unemployment below 4% right now. Is it possible that the Fed is keeping interest rates too low right now, or what do you think?
I think the Fed is right to recognize that any error in letting inflation rise a little bit too much is likely to be a reversible error. And any error in terms of tipping the economy into recession is likely to take a very long time to reverse. I'm one who believes that we have a very different economy than we used to. Therefore, I think the approach that's being pursued is okay, and I would not be one to criticize it, certainly not one to criticize it on the grounds that we should have even more rapid increases in interest rates than we do.
I have an interesting theory that I just heard from somebody in the banking industry at a major bank, and he was saying that the unemployment rate may actually be getting so low that there are going to be a lot of people hired for jobs that they shouldn't have, being paid too much money, and that's where inflation is going to come from. What do you think about that?
It's possible. There is some evidence that at the end of expansions, there's a tendency for productivity growth to slow. And that may be for the reason you're companion suggests, that when labor is in short supply, some of the people hired are a bit less qualified. But it seems to me that what is striking is how slow any pressure for inflation is. And perhaps that's because of the price discipline posed by foreign competition, posed by technology. So I think it would take quite a lot to generate a substantial acceleration in American inflation.
I want to ask you about one more thing, which is that we're talking as the stock market is at record highs. A lot of people are worried that, you know, we've been in an expansion for a long time now, that a recession is on the way. What are your thoughts at this point about that?
I'd be surprised if sometime in the next 3 years we didn't have a recession. Evidence is that it's very hard to predict recessions. And so the fact that we don't see one coming doesn't assure us that one is not coming. I think you have risks in the geopolitical environment. You have risks that the Fed will tighten too fast. I think you have risks that elevated asset prices will just, at a certain point, run out of steam. And when people no longer buy them because they're confident they go up, they can actually fall quite sharply. So I think you have a situation that has a number of real risks associated with it. And I would be somewhat surprised, not shocked, but somewhat surprised if the expansion was still healthy 3 years from now. And I would be very surprised if growth next year wasn't considerably slower than growth this year.
And do you think that the effects of the midterm elections are going to have a big impact on the economy?
I think it's hard to know. I'd be surprised if they had a huge effect, because I would be surprised if you see substantial policy change in Washington, regardless of what happens in the midterm election. I think the greater chance is of erratic actions in the international arena that have consequences, but those are less affected by the result of the election.
It's Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We will remember. It's November. We will remember. It's November.
Some voters in Maine putting pressure on Republican Senator Susan Collins, as she is seen as one of the key swing votes on whether Brett Kavanaugh will be confirmed to the Supreme Court. Protests have continued over the past couple of weeks, and yesterday nearly two dozen protesters and survivors of sexual assault showed up at Collins' office in Portland. Joining us now is Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. He's in Augusta. Steve, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And when you talk to voters in Maine, what's the temperature right now? How much pressure are they putting on Susan Collins?
Well, I haven't seen anything like it, to be honest with you, Jeremy. It's, you know, we should just back up a little bit. Senator Collins has been under a lot of pressure ever since President Trump was elected president, because she was always seen as sort of somebody who might be able to block his worst impulses, perhaps, and because her reputation as a centrist. And so everybody's sort of looking to her on this particular nomination as perhaps blocking it. And, you know, who knows if that's going to happen or not, but the pressure has been sustained and intense, and it's especially increased since the sexual assault allegations surfaced earlier last month.
Well, but even before the allegations, we know that Susan Collins says she is pro-choice, and many look at Brett Kavanaugh and say he is somebody who may want to overturn Roe versus Wade, even though he has said, I guess, to her privately that he thinks it's settled law.
Correct. Yeah. And that was the initial sort of trigger for the protest. There are other additional concerns. But it's true that the Roe versus Wade question has been center of mind for a lot of people, and especially women who are expected to be a particularly potent force in the upcoming midterm elections.
Has she said anything since the testimony last Thursday from Dr. Ford and Brett Kavanaugh?
Not much. I mean, the only thing that she's said is that she is supportive of the this FBI probe that is going to dig a little bit deeper into those allegations. She has said that. But other than that, she's really keeping a low profile, you know, I think probably just waiting for the outcome of that FBI inquiry to decide how she's going to vote.
Now, Maine is a state that is represented in the governor's office by a pretty conservative Republican, Paul LePage. How much pressure does Collins face from conservatives?
That's a good question. I mean, right now, what you're seeing is overwhelming pressure from progressive groups, but lying in wait, I suspect, if she were to vote against Kavanaugh or even signal that she would oppose his nomination, would be certainly a backlash from conservatives. And, you know, certainly Governor Paul LePage has exerted some of that pressure on Collins personally in the past. He did it during some key health care votes last year. And I would imagine that he would do the same if she had given any kind of indication that she would oppose Kavanaugh's nomination. She hasn't done that yet. She's struck me as somebody who's been wanting to get to yes on Kavanaugh over the last month or so. But that may, you know, if something happens, if something comes up during this FBI probe that raises questions for her and she somehow signals that she would oppose him, I would expect that she would see as much pressure on the right as she's been seeing on the left.
That's Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
We've spoken here over the years about early retirement, a couple who sold their home, traveling and staying in other people's homes to save money, a millennial who worked day and night to earn $1 million and live off investment income. Well, there's now a name for this. It's called FIRE, Financial Independence, Retire Early. And FIRE is on fire, inspired in part by books like Your Money or Your Life and stoked on blogs, podcasts, and Reddit message boards, sharing ideas like house hacking. You buy a home, rent out all the rooms, you crash on the couch, or work at a place with free food. Scott Rickens and his wife Taylor are on fire. They were earning $160,000 a year, living in a beach town, driving a BMW, and then, well, let's let Scott tell it. He joins us from Bend, Oregon. Scott, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, nice to speak with you. And I understand you heard a podcast with one of the gurus of this movement, Mr. Money Mustache. This is Pete Adney. What was it that he said that made you and your wife so abruptly change your lives? You moved, you started saving, you were determined to retire. What did you hear?
Initially, what was so intriguing to me was he sounded so optimistic. And for someone who's living on $27,000 a year, which is how he was introduced on that podcast, that was very interesting to me. At that time, I was actually looking for my own million-dollar idea to kind of get out of the stresses that I felt from our spendy lifestyle.
Talk about those stresses. You are a creative director at a creative agency, and I'm imagining the homes got nicer and the cars got nicer and the clubs you belong to got nicer. Is that... Was there that kind of escalation going on?
That's exactly right. It was this unintentional lifestyle creep. We originally moved into this little 500-square-foot apartment in this little beach town, and our costs were much lower then. And, you know, as we got older and we had a baby, you know, some of our needs were changing, but also our tastes. You know, we found ourselves eating out quite a bit. We found ourselves moving to a larger 3-bedroom apartment. And, you know, we moved there when the recession was in full force. But fast forward a couple of years and things were gaining steam and rents were going through the roof. And, you know, I'll be honest that my financial literacy wasn't in top shape at that time. And so to hear that someone was that happy living on $27,000 a year is what was so intriguing to me in the beginning.
Well, the other thing that happened is that your wife, Taylor, she looked at a retirement calculator.
So once I started going down the rabbit hole and learning about some of these tactics and strategies from now my friends, but at the time my heroes, I implemented the retirement calculator to kind of understand our situation. And when I first plugged the numbers into what current spending was, it looked like we would probably be retiring in our 80s. And when I ran some models on what I thought we could live on reasonably based off of some major life changes, I realized that we could probably retire in about 10 years if we really stuck to it. That's what put her over the edge.
Okay, so this sense that you could be unburdened from the cost of your own lifestyle, that you could get out of maybe a rat race you'd gotten into, did you not like your job?
You know, it's funny. I personally really liked my job. And for me, it's not about work. For me, it was about freeing myself from this idea of mandatory labor. You know, there's passions that I have that may not necessarily coincide with earning a lot of money or earning money at all. And to have the time to pursue that felt like more like the type of life I'd want to live. So when I realized that there was a potential for that, I mean, it was intoxicating.
Okay, so a couple of things. First of all, when you say this mandatory labor, many of us just say, you mean a job? Which is, you know, how the world turns around. But what you and your wife did, just to keep the story going, is it's a major part of this FIRE movement. It's called arbitrage. You moved. You had to move to a less expensive town. So you're in Bend, Oregon now. But I just got to call out something that I'm seeing from a lot of these people who are in the FIRE movement. A lot of you seem really creative. So you are making a documentary about your FIRE movement, and you're writing a book about your FIRE movement. Haven't you just replaced your creative director job with film director author?
You know, it's funny. I've now met a lot of people in this FIRE community. And the one thing that seems to stay very relevant and true is that, you know, you don't meet a lot of people who are just straight up retired doing absolutely nothing.
Right.
I haven't met anyone that's been like that.
And we should say there's different levels. This is according to our reading. There's lean FIRE, where people are extremely frugal. Fat FIRE, where people have a more typical standard of living, but they save and invest. Barista FIRE, you work part-time at like a Starbucks so you can get health insurance. But the investing, the investing part, talk about that, because this isn't like decades ago when Scott and Helen Nearing, two incredible people, decided to live off the land and kick the rat race, and they wrote a book called Simple Living. I can't recommend it enough. But their whole goal was not to make too big a footprint. We're seeing that this isn't really that. A lot of this is people who are working very hard to play the investment game and have enough investments that they can live off their investments, which is very different, you know, than kind of the hippie getting out of the rat race.
One of the main draws for me was the ease at which the investment strategy takes place. And when I found out about index funds, these low-cost index funds, and how much money you could save by not having a financial advisor, you're essentially betting on the stock market, which in its history has always gone up. Now, it goes through these big dips and dives. And if you can ride those waves, if you can ride those lows, you'll end up on the right side of that.
Okay,
when I realized it was as easy as set it and forget it, that was really, really a nice entry point for me.
Well, and part of this, in order to do this, there's a sort of a goal in the FIRE movement of 70% savings.
The whole framework is really flexible. If you increase your savings rate by 10%, you're 10% better off. My wife and I made it to a 70% savings rate. And to be completely honest with you, we're absolutely miserable. And we took great lengths to get there. The reason why we made the film and wrote the book is we're trying to share our story with people so that they can understand what it's like, so that they can eliminate the excuses that's stopping them.
But what were some of the changes you made to help save that money, that even though you were miserable, what were some of the things you were doing?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we did was we set a whole, adventure up to go and find the new place to live. We wanted to make sure that our quality of life wouldn't suffer. You know, there were a lot of different things that we implemented, but part of that was, since we were on the road for a year, we went and spent some time living with our parents for a couple of months to save as much money as we possibly could, get them a little bit of time with their new granddaughter, and we thought that'd be a nice combo punch. What we found was that being in our mid-30s with a two-year-old living in the basement of our parents' house maybe was a little extreme, maybe a bad idea. And then on top of that, I think there was a lot of unknowns. leaving a community behind that we invested in, that we loved, leaving our friends, leaving what we knew. And I think we kind of dealt with that stuff while we were living in the parent, in our parents' base.
And by the way, people have pointed out, this isn't something you can do if you don't have parents you can move in with, or if you have a huge student loan debt, or if you don't, you know, if you don't work in an area where you can reap a high salary and then turn it around and invest it in your future. So it's not for everyone. But just so here you are doing this. And I've been hearing of people doing FIRE with like 1 million, 1.2 million, 1.5 million invested. That seems, that's a lot of money. But you're potentially going to live 70 more years. I mean, have you ever thought about that?
Of course, we definitely have thought about that. And that's something that, you know, we were definitely nervous about and asked a lot about in the beginning. And there's a couple things to that. I think the first thing is the whole premise of financial independence and your investments making enough that it can sustain you is based off of this thing called the Trinity Study. And it essentially works out the math to be about a 98% chance that you won't run out of your principal investments over the course of 30 years if you draw 4% off of that. And the idea is that the stock market continues to grow. And if it continues to grow as it has in the past, then you can always sip a little bit off of the top and you'll never run out of what you had. At the end of the day, one of my dear friends and one of my favorite FIRE podcasters, her name is Paula Pant. We were asking her this question and she said, you know, the worst case scenario is you go back to work. I think for us, the real point here was gaining financial literacy and understanding how money works in our life and what our relationship to money is. And once we saw it as a tool and something that we had more power over, this the freedom and the stress that was relieved, that's the magic of FIRE in its essence.
That's Scott Rickens. He retired in his early 30s. He is part of the FIRE movement, Financial Independence, Retire Early. Of course, he has a book and a doc and a blog. So he's still busy. But Scott, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
And a lot of people in the FIRE movement are being paid, you know, advertisers run their blogs. But are you on FIRE? You know, what are you doing to save money? HereNow.org.
Polar bears are the largest land carnivore on Earth, but they're also marine mammals. And in the last couple of decades, the Arctic sea ice has been melting from under them. Nowhere is this more visible than in the tiny Alaska village of Kaktovik on the Arctic coast. And while there's been some alarm about how vulnerable polar bears are to climate change, in Kaktovik, melting sea ice has created another problem: too many bears on solid ground. Jennifer Pemberton from Alaska's Energy Desk reports from the Arctic.
There have always been polar bears around Kaktovik, but they used to be miles out on the sea ice, hunting their favorite prey, ringed seals. In the mid-1990s, that started to change. Researchers noticed that female bears were making dens more often in the snow, on land, rather than out on the ice. And locals started noticing more bears on land and in town than ever before. And so the community asked for help.
The Fish and Wildlife Service biologists started hearing about increasing numbers of polar bears on land from residents as early as the early 2000s.
Jennifer Reed works for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which surrounds Kaktovik. She and other federal wildlife managers came in and started teaching people bear safety, like what to do when a bear came into the village and how to get it to leave without hurting it. And then in 2008,
today, I am listing the polar bear as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act.
Secretary of the Interior Dirk Kempthorne announced that polar bears were threatened in the United States, not because their numbers were declining, but precisely for the reason they were coming ashore in Kaktovik. Their habitat was melting away. Suddenly, the whole world was aware of the polar bear's plight, and that's when outsiders started showing up in Kaktovik. Tourists who wanted to see the polar bears before they went extinct.
Before 2011, you know, visitor numbers for polar bear viewing in Kaktovik were, gosh, less than 50 annually. Today, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of visitors, many from around the world each year.
More than 2,000 people came to Kaktovik last year to see polar bears. That's a major tourism boom for a town this small and a place this remote. Most of the tourists come in the fall. That's when the sea ice is farthest away from the shore, forcing the bears toward land. And it's also when the people of Kaktovik harvest 3 bowhead whales. At the edge of town, there's a huge pile of bones, where the community has been taking their whale remains for decades. For some bears, these scraps are an alternate food source when there's no ice for hunting seals. It's not safe to walk to the edge of town alone any time of year, and so I hitch a ride with Bruce Inglangasik. He's an Inupiaq subsistence hunter and offers wildlife viewing tours, including polar bear tours in the fall. He says he's seen a lot of changes since he moved to Kaktovik. Bigger storms, less sea ice, more polar bears.
What are we looking at here?
This is the Beaufort Sea. The dark spots you see right here, that's the Barnard Spit. And that's where we do our polar bear viewing, all on the inside right here.
Is that where the bone pile is?
No, the bone pile is at the end of the old airstrip over here.
We drive down the old military runway, a relic of the Cold War. Even in summer, the road is covered in so much snow, we can't get any closer than maybe a half mile.
I don't know how much further I can go.
Yeah. Can I take a picture of the bone pile?
Oh, yeah.
That's as close as we're going to get.
Yeah.
No bears.
Yep, no bears. We see them here year-round. All winter, we see them going east or west. Like I told you, they migrate along the coastline where the pressure ridges are. That's where the seals have their dens.
By mid-September, the ice will be gone, and some bears will be stranded near Kaktovik until the sea starts to freeze again in October or November. Those stranded bears are a guarantee for tourists. But not everyone is on board with the attraction. When Inglangasik became a licensed guide, he says 90% of the town was against commercial tourism.
Why were people opposed to it initially?
The community was scared about, you know, activists that was going to try to get us to shut down the whaling, subsistence whaling. But that's not true.
The tourists haven't stopped whaling, but there are people in Kaktovik who feel like visitors gawk at their subsistence activities. They see it as an invasion of their privacy. Also, there's this. Late last year, Congress opened up the part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge where Kaktovik is located to allow oil development and exploration. Some people in town are preparing for a potential oil boom. It could be a game changer for the whole region. And that makes polar bear tourism and the money it brings in seem like a drop in the bucket compared to the potential of oil. But that's months or years away. For now, there's plane load after plane load of tourists eager to see Alaska's most iconic endangered species. For Here and Now, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
As long as they're just seeing the polar bears and not hurting them.
Mm-hmm.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.